Welcome to the Mindful Fire Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. My dad will be so grateful. See you next time on the Mindful Fire Podcast.
Welcome to the Mindful Fire Podcast, a show about crafting a life you love and making work optional using the tools of mindfulness, envisioning, and financial independence. I'm your host, Adam Cuello, and I'm so glad you're here. Each episode of the Mindful Fire Podcast explores these three tools through teachings, guided meditations, and inspiring interviews with people actually living them to craft a life they love. At its core, Mindful Fire is about creating more awareness and choice in your life. Mindfulness helps you develop self-awareness to know yourself better and what's most important to you by practicing a kind, curious awareness. Envisioning is all about choosing to think big about your life and putting the power of your predicting brain to work to create the life you dream of. And financial independence brings awareness and choice to your financial life, empowering you to make your vision a reality by getting your money sorted out and ultimately making work optional. And here's the best part. You don't have to wait until you reach financial independence to live out your vision. Mindful Fire is about using these tools to craft that life now on the path to financial independence and beyond. If you're ready to start your Mindful Fire journey, go to mindfulfire.org/start and download my free envisioning guide. In just 10 minutes, this guide will help you craft a clear and inspiring vision for your life. Again, you can download it for free at mindfulfire.org/start. Let's jump into today's episode. Welcome to the Mindful Fire Podcast, Ashanti. I'm so thrilled to have you here.
Man, I'm glad to be here with you, man. Good to see you again.
It's been a while, but I'm always happy to spend time with you in person or virtually.
Yeah, thank you, man. I'm excited to be in this conversation.
So I'd love to start by just sharing with the audience a little bit about how we know each other. And if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you probably have noticed a pattern that I tend to meet really awesome people randomly. Like the universe brings me in contact with amazing people. And Ashanti is an incredible example of this. What was it, like 5 or 6 years ago now? We were both at a conference called Wisdom 2.0, which I've talked about on the podcast a couple of times, all about mindfulness meeting technology. And it happens every year in San Francisco. And this was my first year going to the conference. And so I was like super excited. And I ended up in a room that was absolutely packed, just standing room only, everyone all around this room. And it was a 45-minute workshop called Taking Off the Mask. And I was like, this sounds interesting. What is this? And so I went in there, and what transpired was just this incredible experience where I had some real insight into how I'm showing up in my life. And then there were some small groups I remember that were just really an amazing connected experience between me and the other people there, just sharing authentically, knowing that it was going to stay in that group. And so it seems like every year I'm at a point around Wisdom 2.0 time where I'm just like, the beginning excitement of the year has worn off, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? And I really needed some pick-me-up. And this was an amazing pick-me-up. And so I didn't meet him then. Ashanti was, if it wasn't obvious, Ashanti was running this session. And then I ended up, I'm thinking, man, I got to meet this guy. He's amazing. And later on in the day, I went to the main stage. And this was a room that probably had 3,000 people in it. And as I walked into the room and Ashanti was already on stage, I just felt this energy. Like, and I'm not one to talk about energy, but I felt just this feeling when I walked into this room and you were sharing your story about the work that you do. And I remember after your talk, there was a standing ovation, right? And I'm like, who is this guy? I gotta meet this guy. Like, you have like Harvard professors and like NFL athletes on stage. No one's getting a standing ovation. And This guy I've never heard of, who just led this amazing session, has got everyone in this room just totally captivated. And so I'm like, oh my God, I got to meet this guy. I don't know how it's going to happen. And that night at the after party, which is always one of my favorite parts of the conference, I am standing there talking with my boss, who is into all this stuff as well, my boss, Paul, and we're just chatting and stuff and hanging out. And all of a sudden, walking towards me is Ashanti. And I'm like, oh my God, there he is. I got to meet him. And so I like was like, oh my God, Ashanti, like that, your talk and your workshop, it was amazing. It was so great. It's so good to meet you. And it was just from then, it was like, we were friends that were like meeting each other again. I don't know if you felt that way, but I felt that way.
Yeah. I can't stop grinning because I'm having the flashback of that entire scenario of experiences when we had the chance to do the workshop and some of my students were there. And then the talk on stage, that event was one of these pivotal moments of our work and connecting to more folks in the Bay Area. And yeah. And then we're a small organization and your energy was inspiring me more. And I was like, should I invite him to be on our board? And I was really shy about inviting people to be on our board because I'm like, our board needed a lot of work. And it was like barely scrubbing along, like the little train that could. And I was like, I can't ask him here. I'll ask him later. And you were like, there's everything I can do. And I'm like, oh, he said it, but do I believe it? I was like, does he really mean it? Like I was in that. I said, well, we should talk because I need some help. And you were like, okay. And then I think 2 days later, you called me. Like I was going to give it 4 days. I was like, let me give it 4 days for the reality to wear off, whether this is real or not. And then you called me and I was like, oh my God, this is real. This is, you know, sometimes you think you're dreaming, you meet people and you're like, nah, they don't really mean it. That's what I say to myself. That's the story I tell myself is that, nah, they're just being nice. And when you reached out, I was going to give it 2 more days. And then I was like, oh, this is right. This is happening. And yeah, and it's been a connection ever since.
Yeah. And, you know, we've done a bunch of things together. It just clicked for me. What you're working on, I was like, this makes so much sense. I want to be a part of this. And so I had you to Google it. My first ever talk at Google that I hosted. Right. We did the taking off the mask exercise for people in the room. And you can find that. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. That's on YouTube. And then we did Google Serve event, I think 3 years in a row.
That's right.
So just so much good stuff came out of that. And I'll tell you, I like that presentation I did for the young men about like emotional intelligence and stuff. And I was way too long and they lost interest halfway through, which I should have known and expected. But I use that all the time. Like I pull from that. That's just like everything I could use for all of the workshops I do at Google. Like yeah. I take from that all the time, building block for what I'm doing now, which is pretty cool to see as well.
Yeah.
And so
that was amazing.
Yeah. So we've done a lot of cool stuff together, which is awesome. And I'm happy to have you on the podcast.
You even come to when I was at Arise High School, like that work, like it's been a journey of the events and connections. And I'm so appreciating that. And I think part of it is also if you had not got inspired to say, I'm going to reach out, you could have easily have just like, oh, that was maybe I'll reach out. But like taking that next step to like, actually do it. There were lots of people at that little event. You could have just kept talking to Paul there and like just been like, oh, maybe I will. And I think sometimes it's that moment of like, do I take a step? Do I go say something to this person? And thank goodness you were able to like push yourself past the good idea and put the idea into action. And I think that's part of the work that I believe is so important when we can take an idea that our heart calls us to do and we put through all the negative other voices out that says, don't, why would you do that? But you go forward with your best intentions. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point there. We often have these ideas, these feeling call to say something or do something or reach out to somebody or whatever. And we all have these things we want to do in our life. And if we sit on them too long, we come up with a million reasons why we shouldn't or why it won't work. And I think back to me wanting to do my first solo episode of the podcast, which I talked about for a long time. And I just come up with all these reasons why, you know, oh, not, it's not the time. Oh, I'm tired or whatever. There's all these things that come up and get in the way. So yeah, sometimes we just need to take that step and amazing things happen because of that.
That's right. It's amazing how it happens, right? You look back and you're like, if I hadn't have done that one little thing, then maybe that other thing couldn't have happened and that other thing couldn't happen. And then all the things that kind of springboard and the ripples in the pond of all the things that would not have happened if the one thing had kicked it off. And it's beautiful.
That's life, right?
That's right, man. That's right.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love reliving that story with you, man. That was such an amazing time. And yeah, so I'd love to have you share with the audience a little bit about yourself, your journey, and what you're up to in the world. I alluded to a lot there. I would love to have you share in your own words the impact you're making in the world.
So I'm Ashanti Branch from Oakland, California. I was raised by a single mother. My father died before I was born. I tell people that no one asked me my opinion about it. I just showed up here on the planet and life was a mess and I was supposed to know how to navigate and deal with it. I'm reading this book called It Didn't Start With You. And it's about how childhood trauma starts sometimes even before we even in the womb. And one thing I've been learning recently is that while my mom was grieving, and this is 3 months before I was born, so a lot of development stuff is happening. Like I'm swimming in sadness. I'm swimming in her womb of sadness and grief and wondering how is she going to survive raising this baby by herself. And one thing I realized was that I grew up a very emotional boy in a community of Oakland, California, very somewhat dangerous, violent, somewhat activated by this hyper-masculine narrative that says, boys don't cry. You can't show your feelings. I feel everything. I feel a movie that has a sad ending. I feel a TV show that goes, like I feel, and I'm told in the community, boys don't cry, suck it up, man up. At 7 years old, I was supposed to be the man of the house. I was supposed to be the man of the house. My uncle said, take care of your mom and your sister and your brother. I'm like, oh, I don't really want that job. Can you find the man who's supposed to be here? But we were trying to figure it out. And I was responsible for my siblings. I was helping take care of them. I did a lot of raising and cooking and cleaning and navigating and house making. And I remember just a journey of like my own life of figuring out how do I be this man at 7 years old. So you imagine me in elementary school when teachers are telling me what to do. Like, you can't tell me what to do. I'm a man. You know what I'm saying? Imagine that juxtaposition of your roles, right? In my mom's house, I'm never in charge. She's always in charge. So I don't get to pull that with her. But anyone else who tried to tell me what to do, I'm like, you can't tell me what to do. I'm a man. They're like, you a little boy. I'm like, you don't know me. I'm a man. Like, you know what I'm saying? Imagine me having a battle with an educator who thinks that they can. And it was a battle because my uncle had given me this role. He had given me this job. And I was like, oh, that's how it works. I get to hold this idea that I'm a man in my head, but on the outside world, I'm still a little boy. So it was sometimes complicated. I'm telling you the story because I, you know, that's the beginnings are how it all started. So imagine I find out there's a formula to live happy ever after. They told me, they said, if I study hard, go to college, get a good job, make a lot of money, I could live happily ever after. That's a 5-point plan. I'm like, hey, say that again. They said, study hard, go to college, get a good job, make a lot of money, live happily ever after. I'm like, sign me up because I won't be happy ever after. I know my life is not happy often, if ever, but definitely happy ever after is what I'm looking for. And so I basically started pushing hard for happy ever after. And what ends up happening is I'm working hard at trying to be a good kid, but also like on this strategy plan. Now, in middle school, I was a mess. If you knew me in middle school, you'd be like, this kid is going to be in trouble. And if it wasn't for Miss BP, a teacher changed my life. And she told me one day in detention, she said, Ashanti, life doesn't give you what you want. Life gives you what you get. You got to make the most out of it. And that sentence changed my life. I'm like, before that, I was just sad and angry. I had no father. I was worried about that. And so that journey began to get my act together. I was like, okay, fine. Instead of being sad that my father's not here and worried about the fact that I don't have a father, I'm going to just try and make him proud. And when I changed the context, it all changed. From that point forward, I was an amazing student. I told myself, my name is Ashanti Branch. I will get no grade lower than a B ever. I had this like thing in my head. I would never get lower than a B. And so I was like, I'm going to make my father proud, even though he can't be here to watch me do it. And I was hustling. Teachers were confused. Teachers were like, what's wrong? Ashanti, what's going on? You're doing homework. You're doing work. Why are you paying attention so well? I'm like, this work ain't hard. But before, I had no purpose. I had no purpose to why to work because I was holding this image of being sad and afraid and worried and missing out in my life, as opposed to like, I get to make a formula that changes the future. So then it was on. High school, college, I go to college to be an engineer. I wanted to make money. They told me, hey, you're good at math. You could be an engineer. I'm like, what's that? They were like, these are the type of engineers. What things you like? I said, I like big buildings and bridges. They're like, you should be a civil engineer. I'm like, okay, let's go. I started working towards being a civil engineer, went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, majored in civil engineering, graduated, started making big money. It was beautiful. Went home for a year to two to pay off my loans, debt free, started living in fancy Walnut Creek, which is in the Bay Area. Just listen to the sound of that place, Walnut Creek. You can just imagine what it looks like.
I've never been there. I lived in the Bay Area for 10 years, never been to Walnut Creek, but it does sound nice.
You missed it. You missed it. That was a wild place. And then while in this engineering, my first 5 years, something started calling me. This teaching thing started calling me. And I'm like, not me. Teaching? Why would I do that? Like, who would possess somebody who's making all this money to go and get a job where you're going to get paid very little, get blamed for all the problems in education, be responsible for 30 people at a time who don't do their work and you get blamed? Like, what? You are tripping. Not me. And I remember like hearing the call, but like, I'm out. That's somebody else's calling. Now, imagine when you're hearing a calling on your life. There's one thing to be doing is saying, I hear something calling my life to do something different. And being like, nope, not me. Now, have you ever had a calling on your life and you tried to it's almost like what Joseph Campbell talks about, the hero's journey, right? There's a call to the adventure of your life. And then there's a resistance of the adventure. You imagine, think about all the hero stories. Think about Star Wars, right? Like Luke was called. He was like, what are you talking about? I'm just a little kid over here doing this thing. I ain't got nothing special about me. And he had to resist it before he could get to the next place where he was like, maybe there's something into that. And I don't know all the story of Star Wars. I may be just getting it all wrong, but the call to adventure is in every, this idea, the hero's journey is in every story, every hero story. And what I realized in my life is that when he was calling me to come teach, I was like, I don't want to teach. I want to make money. And teachers don't make money. So it can't be for me. I worked all this way to become rich. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was my goal. Cause I know I've already done my poor time on earth. I know what poor feels like. And I'll tell you, it ain't fun. And I don't think anybody ever chooses to be poor. But I know circumstances can cause financial instability in lives, and I've lived it. And so I'm like, I don't want that. And so I'm telling you that part too, because the journey of me making a decision between staying in the money and leaving to become a teacher was a hard journey. When the person asked me the question, what was the moment that you decided to leave engineering and become a teacher? That must have been like a big decision. Was there a moment? And I'm like, well, there was lots of moments. But one of the moments in particular was, so I was on this big project in San Jose called Santana Row. And that project was the biggest project of its time, $700 million multi-use residential, commercial. One of the buildings had a 1 acre floor print, one of the biggest buildings, floor print buildings like that I had ever heard of and that many people had ever heard of. And I was in Mexico. Like, you know, that my project was on that biggest building. I was in charge of all the elevators for the whole project and some other interior pieces, but elevators, there were so many elevators that was, you know, pretty much a full-time space. I was in Mexico. I was in this bar. I think it was in Oaxaca at the time. There was a TV playing and it was usually playing wrestling, but it was playing like, it was a commercial and it was like news at 8. And you can't hear the words because it's a bar, it's music playing, but there's this playing. And I look up and it was like, San Jose, California, which is EEU, which is United States. And I'm like, and I'm looking at the street and I'm like looking at the fire. Like, this thing is on, it's blazing. And I'm like, that's my project. Wait, what's going on? Wait, project's on fire. Now this is 2002. So 2001. So this is before Facebook. This is before Instagram. This is like no Twitter. I couldn't go and look online. It was like, it wasn't. I had to wait till I could get to a phone to call somebody. I had no fancy cell phone back then. It was like, my project is on fire. Do I even have a job when I go back? Now, when you're in construction, if something catches on fire, there's definitely a job. There's a lot more work to do when you get back because you got fire restoration and all that stuff. But nonetheless, it was one of those moments where I was like, is this a sign that I'm like, I could stay. It wasn't like that my job was going to end. My job was actually going to get harder. But it was almost like maybe it was a moment of like, wake up call to be your time. It's time. It's time to let it go, right? And to go and do the thing that I think was calling me, but I was running from. And yeah, it was one of those moments where I was like, okay. And so that was the story I was going to tell you, that making that journey of deciding that I'm going to leave engineering and become a teacher. And I think when I look back, I think I was pretty smart. I'm like, maybe I should have strategized a little bit. Maybe I should have saved a little bit more. Maybe I should have. How much would I have saved? What's a number that would have been enough to be like, okay, now I can go make a job where I'm going to make 66% less than I make now and be able to still have a decent lifestyle, right? Where how fast the savings will subtract as the income doesn't match. I don't think I ever would have left because it would have made sense numbers wise. As a numbers game, it never would have made sense. It doesn't even make sense today. Sometimes I look back, that was almost 19 years ago. I'm still not making as much as I was making then. It almost feels sometimes backwards. it almost feels sometimes emotionally, I have to like really, like I feel it coming up now. Like sometimes emotionally, I have to check myself because if I let the numbers guide me, I'll be sad. Because I worked hard in high school. I went to college. I worked hard in college. I worked hard in my career. And then my heart was like, hey, yeah, that money's nice over there, but this is what you're supposed to be doing. And I'm like, no, find somebody else. You know what I'm saying? I'm totally satisfied in what I have done. But when I get a chance to be honest about it and talk about it, sometimes it's a dissonance. It's a, I think Paulo Freire talks about a choque, like a crash. Like a, it's almost like a conflict between what my heart says brings me a lot of joy. And then what the other part of me says, but I also would like to be able to take a vacation and not worry about where I can stay because I only have this much money to work with. Like where I have to be nickel and diamond and waiting for sales to go buy peanut butter because I don't want to. Why? And it's like small stuff that feel big to me because I grew up poor. I grew up deciding I was going to work hard so I didn't have to ever be that worried about my well-being financially. And to go back there, self-inflicted, like it's not like anybody did it to me. So I did it. I own that. It was me. It was that moment of like, okay, Ashanti. I often need to not let myself get locked into that cycle. I give myself sometimes a couple of minutes here and there to be like, some of my friends right now who are still in engineering are like telling me about their jobs and their new promotions and they're like VPs. And I'm just like, wow. And I know that my journey is not their journey. I'm working on doing a better job of not comparing because I know that comparison is a thief of all happiness. And I know it's true. I know it's true because I've done it. I've compared. I've made up a story in my mind about where I could have been. I'm living in an alternate universe of where I could have been, should have been, would have been. And I'm like, stop doing that. And I have to like come back to reality. Like, I am thankful for the work I get to do. I don't feel forced to do it. But I wish that in education, I wish that we paid educators more. I wish the educators could live in the Bay Area and not be stressing about, do I need to go leave this district to go to a new district because they pay like $10,000 more. If you love this district you're in and you want to make more money, there's a district probably 5 miles away, 10 miles away that could probably pay you more. And then you have to decide, okay, I leave the district I really like to go to a district because $10,000 for some families can make a big difference. $20,000, a big difference.
For sure.
And some pay even more. There's some disparities up to like $30,000, $40,000 difference for a first-year teacher. That seems a little bit strange, but it's the reality. And so I don't think money's the only measure. And I think I'm talking about money a lot right now. Just sometimes that is a season and definitely a season that I think about because I made that sacrifice. I have to constantly keep checking myself. Like, are you happy? And I'm willing to be like, if I'm not, what do I need to do to be happier? I don't think this idea of happiness is like, you should be happy every moment of every day, all the time. I think there's room for all ranges of emotions. But sometimes that decision I made a long time ago really comes and presents itself. And if I try and ignore it, I can ignore it for a certain amount of time. Like, but it comes back and it's like, name it. Are you happy where you are? Are you satisfied? I'm satisfied in this category. I'm satisfied in the passion and purpose work I get to do. I'm not necessarily satisfied in the financial longevity of what I've created. And so now, okay, so what do you need to do to increase this other side? How do you get to balance them out? And I think, oh, okay, so I can make some decisions. And those are really beautiful moments where I don't feel stuck. I'm not stuck in anything. I'm not blaming anybody else that I'm making choices to live the life that I dream of living.
I appreciate you sharing that because there's a lot in what you said there. There's the comparison is the thief of all happiness. Anyone ever felt better after comparing their lifestyle to someone else's or even the lifestyle we think we should have? I was talking earlier before we started recording about, yeah, I've been feeling a little bit just like blah and looking to feel a little bit reinvigorated and more aligned with passion and purpose and things like that. But another thing you said is that we have multiple aspects of our life. And so the question you asked, like, am I satisfied? That's a question that a friend of mine, another guest on the podcast, who I met randomly on the internet, I think it was at Wisdom 2.0, maybe even the online version, was what would it take for you to feel satisfied? And that's something that I have not really answered. I haven't really thought enough into it. And what you introduced here is multiple areas of our life. We have our relationships, we have our financial life, we have the purpose and passion, peace, we have our health. and our wellness and our fitness and things like that. And I think I really need to look at that a little bit more on what would that take to feel satisfied in each of these areas.
You know, on my men's team, we have this thing that we do called the five F's. And the five F's are just a way of us, you know, as a team setting goals. And so the five F's kind of come from there's fitness, there's family, there's fun, there's finances. And the F is, it's like a big goal. It's like a thing you've been wanting to do that you just like go for it goal. When I use it with the teenagers, I call it finish it, like a Mortal Kombat, finish it goal, like finish it, like do it, get it done. So those five F's are the ways we just begin to set like goals and say, look, this is a goal that's long-term. This is a goal short-term. If it's a long-term goal, let's begin working on bits and pieces. And I think those are the things that when I was in that decision-making process of transition, no one ever sat with me and be like, let's work on a strategy. If you're wanting to do this and you want to leave, what would be the strategy? I think it would be beautiful to have somebody that could sit with you. I mean, there was not like this coaching movement back in 2001 that I knew about. Definitely they weren't looking for me, but maybe there were a bunch of coaches back then. I think every time I look up, there's new coaches around. But I think the idea is that what would it be like to have somebody say, okay, you want to make a transition? Let's strategize this, okay? What would you need to have in the bank to be able to feel comfortable? I think even just to be able to name the conversation, like without even, when I made the decision, it literally was like, I got accepted to the graduate program. I gave my 2 weeks and then I was like, what'd you just do? What are you doing? It was like a moment of like, are you crazy? Have you lost your mind? You didn't plan this out. You was like, your last check was your last check. It was like, oh, wait. And then you have the little regret, right? You're like, oh, I had regret. But that moment of like, oh, maybe I should have had some strategy along the way to be thinking about this. But I was really in a fire point in my life. Like it was time to make a move and I made the move, but totally a journey of looking back, I think. So as well as to answer those questions, I'm trying to write these stories and think about how it all happened. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I didn't know that. And yeah, a fire happening at your job site and you're already feeling like maybe this isn't for me while you're sitting at a bar in Mexico. Not like you saw it on social media or something. It's just on the TV. That's pretty funny.
Once I decided that I was going to become a teacher, my heart was open and clear and I was doing a horrible job. So went back to school, became a teacher. Now I'm like the teaching first year and I'm doing a horrible job. Like I'm at school every day on time, prepared. I'm doing homework on weekends to make sure I'm ready for my class. And I got kids failing my class. And I think that my grade as a teacher is if my kids are passing. I rarely, every once in a while, I would tell a kid, your failing is your responsibility. My job is to teach. And I realized that as much as I believe that in some ways, I have a deeper responsibility to figure out what am I doing wrong that you, kid, number one, number two, number three, whoever, is not receiving the material. Now, every kid is not going to do the work to pass, but I think every kid's capable. So I told kids in my class, look, if you're going to fail, it's going to be a hard fail because you're going to know that you didn't fail without a clear knowledge that failing was on the way. Like you're going to feel this fail. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm going to be on you every day. You know what I mean? And I think that what I began to learn about me was I wasn't going to be accepting kids giving less than their best. You don't have to get an A in this class. You don't even have to get a B. Maybe you don't even get a C. But if you got a D and you gave your best, you're going to feel like it was $1 million. That's how I wanted students to recognize. Because I don't think that math is challenging for people, but I believe everyone's capable, but you got to be willing and put in the work. So all that to say, so became a teacher. But what I knew that first year was that it had to be more. And Ever Forward Club started my first year teaching. And mind you, I'm running a nonprofit now. If you told me as a first year teacher who had just got my salary dropped by 66%, I did the math, so I knew what it was. That's a real percentage. That it looks like, Ashanti, you're starting a nonprofit. I would have been like, you're out of your mind. How can you get more nonprofit than teaching? I didn't think it was possible. But now that I run a nonprofit, I tell you, it is possible. And if you're not careful, it may be you, right? Like the idea is that I realized that this journey of my education, of me finding my purpose and passion in life, has almost been the negative regression curve of my financial measure of success. If I was to look at the salary that I was making based on when I felt like I was living my purpose and passion compared to where I am, like from the beginning, I was making lots of money, but I was just doing engineering stuff. I mean, I could do it. I was smart at it. I could do it. But do I say I was passionate about it? Yes, a little bit. But it's a very different passion that I live right now. I'm fully passion and purpose, and the financial is not, it went the other way around. And I say that, I speak about money a lot in some of my talks with people because I want them to be clear. Like, I know the kind of life I really dreamed of living on a financial scale, to travel wherever I wanted to travel, to see every continent in the world, to take a one-way trip one day around the world. Not one-way trip. Yeah, one way. Yeah, just go one direction, east or west, and just hit countries along the way. There's a ticket you can buy. When you're poor, you don't know about these kind of tickets. When you start making money, they're like, hey, you can get around the world ticket. And you get to stop in like 6 or 7 places and go all the way around the world in one direction. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do that. Now, as a teacher, that's going to be pretty hard to do just financially. As an engineer, it was totally possible. It was a little strategy, save here, save there. But I say that to say, because I've been on a journey of trying to make sure that I balance those two out. I balance my purpose and passion and a lifestyle financially that feels really good, that I feel good about. And I think I've worked hard to do that. And that's what I'm working on this part now. But started the Everforward Club, first year teaching, 2004. It began to grow. These students were, the young men in my class were hungry. They're hungry for a place where they could show how smart they were, but they weren't ridiculed. See, in my community, smart wasn't cool. So if you want to be cool, you can't be like a nerd. You can't be smart. And I remember that feeling as a student. So when I created Everforward, I wanted to create a safe space for those young men to be brilliant, be amazing, and know that they weren't going to be made fun of, that it was going to be accepted, that it was actually expected. That in this room, not only are you going to be expected to do hard work, you're going to be respected for doing hard work, and you're going to be inspected. Are you giving your best to do hard work? And that space became Everforward Club. So Everforward Club started. Students were like, you're part of Everforward? I want to be a part of Everforward. Our club grew faster. I didn't even know what I was doing. I had no curriculum. It was just a space for young people to be heard and seen. And our meetings always had lunch. I told these young men when we first started, look, I'll buy you lunch once a week. In exchange for lunch, you teach me how to be a better teacher. And that's how it started. And so it makes me fast forward. I was teaching at this first school, San Lorenzo High School in the Bay Area. And then I go on a Fulbright fellowship to India. I come back. I have a new principal who is not a big fan of me. There's a lot of chaos in education. And look, as a teacher, I've taught for 10 years. I was an administrator. And now I work on the outside of schools. I've seen when leaders are make it hard for educators to do their work. I've experienced it. So then I moved to a new school. I went to a school in Marin, a private school, as a math specialist. And I saw what it looks like for a school who, on a financial scale, will pay teachers really well and create a learning environment that is almost second to none. And you're like, oh my goodness. Like, the difference between a public school and a private school, and I'm talking about independent school, like independent schools are the top 2% of all schools in the country. 2%, which means these kids are paying top money for their to go to education for their school. I realized that my work was in the mix of that. Like, I was like, oh wow. What do we need to do for our kids to get some of this, to get an experience like this? I first saw it in India where kids were hungry for learning. I saw it in Marin County where kids were like thriving. So I'm like, okay, it can happen here. We got to figure out how to like make it work. And then all I know is that my working through education was how I began to get connected to the deeper work of my own self. I did my first men's work, my work, doing some work on myself was 2010, joined the men's team. And it began to really blossom from there. Me first dealing with my own stuff, dealing with my lack of emotional intelligence. Like, I was intelligent, but I didn't navigate my emotions. I stuffed them still. I was still like stuffing them. Sadness, fear, worry, stuff them. Be cool, be outside, be in charge, be the leader. And when I started doing my own healing work, it began to change everything. So 2014, 15, we were featured in a documentary called The Mask You Live In. And that's when the Million Mask Movement started. It was called Taking Off, the workshop is called Taking Off the Mask. But we have been doing this work ever since. And it's been growing. And that's the workshop you experienced in 2016 at Wisdom 2.0. And it's been a journey ever since. And it's been really beautiful to watch more people experience making these masks. And when I talk about the mask, imagine today, if I tell someone to take off the mask, sounds very different than it did 5 years ago. Because now masks somehow are political.
That's a good point. You want to keep that mask on, people. No, just kidding.
That's right. No,
I never thought about that. That's a very different thing. I'm sure that is very top of mind for you.
Oh, it is. Well, because we go to a place and they say, what's the name of your workshop? I said, taking off the mask. They're like, huh? And they're like, I said, oh, we're talking about emotional masks, not your personal protection mask. But you have to explain it now more than ever because people are, they can easily try and pigeonhole you into, are you an anti-masker? Emotional masks. We're talking about if we can get clear about the context. And we've been doing this work since before the pandemic. So as you imagine, what used to be totally easy to just describe in 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, then became really hard to describe in 2020 to tell people to take off a mask. Because they were like, what do you mean by that? So anyway, those are all the pieces that we learned through and we're still organizing through. But that movement, we've collected over 50,000 masks. And these masks are a picture plus six words. We ask people to draw a picture representing a mask of their own self. Then we ask them to write six words, three words for the front, things that we let people see about us, three things on the back, things we don't let people see. And that's a mask. And when you think about the things that you don't let people see, I think you imagine that people begin to really see the realness in each other because they realize they're not the only ones who are carrying around stuff that they're not talking about. They don't let people see. So that was supposed to be a 10-minute story. That was a little longer, but that's the gist of where I've been over the last parts of my life. But thank you for letting me share the story.
Yeah, I love that story. And I see how it grew out of your desire to be a good teacher and having trouble failing at that. And then you created this space for the young men to come and be real, right? To take off the mask and to show up authentically. I'd love to have you talk a little bit more about the taking off the mask exercise as people are listening to this, right?
Yeah.
People that are listening to this, the Mindful Fire podcast, they want to live true to themselves. They want to live in alignment with their values and their purpose. Yeah. How does doing this exercise of taking off the mask enable people to learn more about themselves and live more authentic?
Yeah. When we think about the mask, we think about how do I have a space to talk about what's going on behind what everyone can see? So depending on what you do on a daily basis, you can imagine what is on the outside. What are the qualities of yourself that you let people see gladly? You just name those for yourself. Okay. I let people see that I'm hardworking, I'm dedicated, I'm smart, I'm talented, I'm athletic, I'm handsome, I got six pack, I'm curious. Whatever those words are, the things you let people see. And we've seen lots of words. I have some masks in front of me: creative, happy, tall, nice, kind, funny. Like these are the things that people on the outside let people see gladly. Active. And then if you think about the other, what are the things and parts of yourself you don't let people see, you don't talk about? Now, if you think about those right now for yourself, though, anyone listening, just what are the things that you don't talk about much, that you don't let people see? You really maybe hold back a little bit. Maybe you don't hold it back because you're trying to hide it. Maybe it's just because no one ever asks and you don't think anyone really cares. So it doesn't really come up in any conversations. What if because no one else talks about it, so therefore you don't think you should talk about it? What about all those things? I think those are the places and ways that we begin to find ourselves getting stuck in a conversation that is not complete, right? Because if you're with one group and you're this way, and you're with another group and you're with this way, and who really fully knows you? Here's a question. One of my mentors asked me this question, and I'll ask it to you. Where in your life are you fully known? Where in your life are you fully known? And when he asked me, I was like, nowhere. I was clear about that answer, nowhere. He's like, what do you mean? You're on this men's team, you've been on this men's team for 10 years. They don't fully know you? I said, they know a lot. What about your siblings and your family? I said, yeah, they know a lot too. But who fully knows me? Nobody. And he asked me this next question, which was a part that was difficult to answer, but it was really telling. He said, Ashanti, is it possible to be fully loved if you're not fully known? I'll ask it again. Is it possible to be fully loved if you're not fully known? Man, that question hit me like a load of brick because it's hard to answer. It's like, what do they love? They love what you let them know. They love what you let them see. And I think that's true for most people, right? Now, so anyway, in that question, just you think about it for yourself. That's what I'm hoping people will recognize. Like, where in my life can I be more fully known? And I think that's a question we all have to grapple with. Like, if all our thoughts in our minds was like projected on our forehead, like if all the thoughts that were passing through our mind were projected, like that may not be the best way to make a lot of friends. Like, you'd be like, I got some really wild thoughts that have passed through this mind of mine. And some of them are totally maybe inappropriate or made up or silly or dumb or create or wild out of this world. Like, whatever they are, we create around ourselves the aura of how we want to show up and how I want to show up in the world. And how do I begin to find people who I can be able to be more authentic with? So that's the question. So the people who are listening, where are the places where you can be more your full self?
Yeah, that's some deep questions right there. Those are some deep questions, my man. And that is really hard. I think it's one of those things where, yeah, I would say, where am I fully known? Nowhere. Even within my own mind, I feel like I don't even fully know myself. And I think that this exercise is a path to finding that, as is mindfulness and really just watching what's going on in my head and my body and starting to listen a little bit more closely. Those are really big questions. And I think the reason why the workshop hit me so much when you did it at that first Wisdom 2.0 conference that I was at was that it gave a space, created a space for that reflection. And then I think that the sharing within a group of people who don't know you, never going to see again, and have agreed to keep things confidential gives you a space where you can try to be a little bit more real than you might otherwise.
Maybe take a couple of layers of the mask off. Maybe you can't take it all off. Maybe you're like, I'm going to test a few layers. What if I just tell them about this? Like, I think when we think about masks, I have lots of different ones, but I think when you think about what we can take off and what we can let people see, like everyone doesn't get to see everything, but maybe in certain places, I let them see more of me. And this group over here, they get to see more and more of me. And I think that's what ends up happening. So I think it's so beautiful the way you said it. I have a space where they can see, I can let myself be seen a little bit more and realize that what other people are going through is equally or even maybe more painful than what I'm going through. And not as a comparison, but as an idea of like, I'm not alone. It's not a comparison, but it is a like, oh wait, other people are going through stuff too? How's that possible? Everyone looks so perfect on the outside. And I think that when we think about our social media world today, some people get caught up in comparing their behind the scenes life to other people's highlight reel.
Yeah, that's what it is, right? Social media is the highlight reel and we have the full story of our lives. And we also get so caught up in our own story and our own life and perspective that it's really easy to look at others on the surface and say, oh man, everyone else has got it figured out. But I think what this really shows people, this exercise of taking off the mask, it shows people that everyone's got the backside of the mask. Everyone's got things that they're working on, that they're grappling with, that they don't fully accept. And that is powerful. It's powerful, it's helpful, and it allows us to start loosening the grip on those things that we think are so important to keep behind the mask.
That's right. That's right. And we see when we do workshops with schools, we see that right now. We've done workshops more in schools right now, and students, say like 12th graders, they'll do the workshop and they hear words from the mask. They realize, wait, somebody in here is going through that? Like, what? Like, I think I know all of you. And how is this possible? Now, they don't know whose mask is who because they're all anonymous. But to recognize that people are going through similar stuff, it is absolutely beautiful for them to begin coming to an awareness that's more than intellectual. Well, of course, people are going through real stuff. But when you can hear what people have shared on these cards, and then you say, oh, maybe we should be a little kinder to each other. I mean, that maybe we should be a little bit more aware of what we say to people, because we never know what people are going through behind the smile and the grins and the bright eyes. I think that as we hear more famous and popular culture people say, I was going through this thing and I didn't talk about it, I think it hopefully makes it more relevant for people. And just recently I was just in the car listening to some musical artist who was talking about, he's a hip hop guy who rapped a lot about his battle with drugs. And when he eventually passed, he died. And he died tragically. But if you go back and I've never listened to his music, but recently somebody played some of his music to me. And I'm like, is every one of his songs, is he talking about him being addicted to drugs? Like, did no one like reach out to him and say, hey, brother, like every song we were listening to, I can only listen to a little bit of it. I'm like, it starts off with like, I can't stop doing it. Like, I'm like, wait, and I don't remember his name right now. His name is slipping my mind, but the gist of it is he died, but the thing he rapped about all the time, and you wonder, did anybody hear it? Did anybody hear his calling out for help? It's easy to hear it now. You look back and you're like, I never listened to him, so I only listened to him in the aftermath of what had happened to him. But you're like, did no one ever notice what he was saying in all these songs? Like, he was asking for help. He was like, did anybody see me? Can anybody hear me? Does anybody notice that I'm going through this? And that's where we realized that we could totally be ignoring what people, because maybe we don't think they're really being clear. I don't know what it is. I don't have an answer for that. But I felt that just recently when I was like, wow, like his songs are saying, I need help. I'm stuck in this. I don't want to be doing this. But unfortunately, that's what took him out. So when we go to schools and they do these masks, we help them say, hey, do you see what your kids are dealing with? Do you see what's on their masks? Like, these are the words your students are saying. Their fear and sadness and worry and doubt and anxiety and depression. And can we make sure we let that keep going without doing something about it, bringing awareness to it? That's the work that I believe we have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit more about the work that Everforward does in schools? You bring young men together, but tell the audience a little bit about what that looks like, you know, what that programming is.
Yeah, Everforward started with just a club for young men called Everforward Club. That's our signature work. And it has evolved. The clubs with young men meets once a week. And it was just a space for young men to talk, to be held in a really special place where they're creating this little academic family, like a brotherhood. But it was about giving them space so they could talk about whatever they were going through. That's the Everforward Club as a program. Then when you think about Everforward Club as a movement or as a organizational structure, right now we have Everforward Club, which is the club for young men. We have Everforward Peer Mentoring Club. That's a club that could be co-ed or multiple. Anyone is welcome in the Peer Mentoring Club. That club allows them to have deeper conversations around with all students, and it's not just young men. The Everforward Club specifically is for young men. Peer Mentoring Club is open to all students. Then we have the professional development work we do. So what we realized early on is that we could do a lot of good work with the students, the young men in our program, but if we send them back into classes where teachers are operating from the I'm in charge, I have no faults, I am the all-knowing, all-knowledgeable adults of Oz, then we end up having kids who can read through that because kids are smart. Students get in trouble a lot if they call teachers out on their own misbehavior because teachers have a lot of power and they can ignore the fact that they have to face some of those things. We started doing professional development with educators to really give them tools of how to build healthy relationships. So learning from what we learned ever forward over 17 years of work, how to help educators be better and more mindful. And I just realized that. Man, when I said 17 years, I just realized that that's 17 years of knowledge that we have learned from students because we ask a lot of questions. So professional development, and now we do a lot of professional development in corporate spaces, team building, community building, healthy environments, healthy relationships, right? And then our third program is experiences. So we have the Everforward Million Mask Movement. That's the movement with these cards that people make around the world. We have Taking Off the Mask workshops that we do with teachers, students, adults, community. And we have a couple of events we do every year. The 24-Hour Relay Challenge is our annual community event. And we just created two new products. We have created a game called The Adventure. And The Adventure is about taking these questions, these challenges, and saving a character from some destination. So we gamify this idea of how do you build connection with people. And those are the layers of our work. So when schools invite us in, it really depends on the resources the school has. It depends on the person who we're working with, like the desire to really do some deep change. We recommend that they have a club at their school, whether it's a peer mentoring club or Everforward Club, because we feel that there's a need. So those are the layers of how people can engage with Everforward at their schools or in their communities or their businesses.
Yeah, very cool. And if people want to connect with you on any of those to bring you into their company or their school or donate to the cause, how do they do that?
Yeah, the easiest would be go to everforwardclub.org. That's our website, everforwardclub.org. And they can also see they can find us on social media. They can DM us on all platforms at Everforward Club, Everforward Club altogether. And yeah, that's the best way. We're now the schools are opening back up and they're finding the protocols of how to, you know, do things safely. We're doing a lot more assemblies now and a lot more workshops in schools, which are really being beautiful. So yeah, that'll be the best way for them to find us.
Very cool. So Ashanti, I know that the Everforward Club has been growing quite a bit and that obviously this work is needed now more than ever before. And I imagine that contributes to the growth. How have you adapted as a leader? And what are you learning as you continue to grow the organization?
Yeah, as Everforward grows and as I'm still adapting as a leader, I think one of the things I'm adapting to the most is how hard it is for a founder to kind of start letting go of pieces. I think depending on how deeply connected that you are to the thing you're creating. I've been working on this since 2004, so almost 17 years, well, more than 17 years now. We're moving into our 18th year. It's letting go of pieces, letting go of parts that I feel really like I want to hold on to it. But it's almost like I grow plants. I like plants and I've had a garden before. I don't have one right now this season. But if I think about like plants, if you put a plant in a pot, it's only going to grow as much as that pot can hold the roots of that plant. And at some point, either the plant's going to start toppling over or it's just going to get stagnant and start fading out. And I think that I use that analogy in the sense of organization, because as we need to grow as an organization, if I'm holding on to it, trying to keep it within the grasp of what I can control, it's only going to grow so big. And I think letting go, we have our first full-time hire. He's the director of sales and development, right? Like, how are we going to grow? We got to sell. We got to connect more. We're a nonprofit, but we operate a lot of earned revenue work. Our workshops and games and things like that are ways of us bringing in money. We're not at the mercy of donations, right? We want to be an organization that builds and helps sustain ourselves so that we can support more people and we can grow and we can pay our people really equitable and fair salaries, even working in this service industry. So I think that for me, what feels the most important in terms of what's growing, what I'm growing through right now is the new team member. He's taking off some things off my plate. I didn't realize until we met his first day that I was managing 10 people. They're contractors, employees, and like I never really counted them. I just knew that I had people doing different stuff and I'm trying to keep all these tops spinning at the same time. And I realized, wait, I'm managing 10 people? And I realized why I feel like sometimes I'm not getting a lot done, because I'm doing a lot of delegating, but I'm also doing a lot of checking in with a lot of people. I'm like, why do I feel like I'm not getting a lot done? Well, I'm on the phone all the time, calling conversations all the time because I'm managing 10 people by myself and I didn't even realize it. And so it was almost like this realization that, oh, wow, Shanti, you are doing something bigger than you even thought yourself. And until I saw it on the board in front of me, it wasn't really real. And I think I've gotten to a clearer place. And now that, you know, he's taking on some of those roles and those managing spots, I have to get used to not trying to be in the weeds all the time, because I'm used to being on all the weeds. Like, I know every weed. I know every root. I'm like, okay, where is that? What's that with that? And I think we're having to retrain our own team that here's what you're responsible for and here's how the check-in process is going to work. And I think I'm learning. I think I'm just learning how to be a better leader. I think I'm learning how to be a more effective leader, a different lead in different ways. I think that's been really beautiful for me. So I think that's where I'm at right now in the growth of myself. I'm having to level up my game as a leader. And that's beautiful. And I'm excited about that. And it's hard.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can imagine that is difficult, having done it for so long. 17 years you've been doing this and you've been holding it all together and keeping it growing, keeping it moving. And there's a lot of moving parts. You're dealing with a lot of stakeholders. You got your employees, you got your community, you got the schools, the principals, the teachers, the parents, the kids, like the donors, the companies you're doing things for. Like, yeah, it's a lot to start to loosen the grasp on all of those and start to trust others to execute your vision.
That's the magic word you just said right there. I was actually going to say that. Trust. Mm. It requires trust, right? Like, we don't have a credit card, but people have to make purchases and they have to get my card. And you're like, you have to trust like all these little things. You have to give people account numbers and have to give people like access to stuff. And I'm like, you want my password for that? Why? Even when you and I were working together, when we had to do the stuff around Salesforce, like we were trying to get Salesforce up and running. And I think the guy was like, I need your password to the donor, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, huh? Like, I got to give you the password? Is there any other way? Because in my mind, I'm like, I'm responsible for all those people in that database. And I think it's fear. And I'm working on this idea of where the healthy fear is and where the fear that holds us back, that keeps us stuck in the pot, that's not allowing us to grow. So that's been the part of like, okay, Ashanti, this is my fear. And it's fear. It is fear. I think that I'm easy to name it. And now I'm like working through it.
Yeah. That's interesting that you mentioned the fear. And because when you're talking about, think about what's on the back of the mask, I'm realizing more and more that it's afraid, right? That there's some part of me that's afraid to really show up in my life like it matters, and things are good. I'm very fortunate to have a good job, make decent money, and have a great boss, and like things are good. And but sometimes I let myself stay small or hold myself back because I'm afraid of, I don't know what it is, of showing up fully like it really matters. And I allow myself to say, oh, things are good, as a way to not step into who I know I could be. And or even just to do the work of figuring out who I want to be. I have an idea. The podcast helps me explore that. But I've really started to realize there's a lot of fear. And doing the solo episode that I mentioned earlier really helped me face that fear. And yeah, it's an ongoing process. So yeah. I appreciate you calling that out for yourself, but also you called it out for me as well. Let's shift now into what I call the Mindful Fire Final Four.
Okay.
So the first question is, we haven't really talked about it, but you also have a podcast and you've done a whole bunch of episodes. And I'm curious as to what you've learned in doing the podcast, either its impact on the organization, getting the message out, like really, what have you learned from doing the podcast?
Thank you. That's a beautiful question. I think that's a powerful question. The podcast is called Taking Off the Mask, and it's literally an opportunity for me to talk to other men, and we, men of all ages, our youngest participant has been 12. I think he's 12. He's an eighth grader. Maybe he's 13. I think he's turned 13. Conversation with men about our masks. And so we make a mask and we share it with each other. And I think one of the things I've learned is that so many men are going through similar things that you would never know. I think so far in the episodes I've recorded, you know, I have some childhood trauma around abuse. And I think that I've met, through the podcast, things I didn't know before, probably so far, 4 or 5 men who also experienced childhood abuse in the same way. And I think there's so many people who you would never know by looking at them on the outside, but there's so much stuff we carry. And I think I know that intellectually and I know it real. And it's always really a beautiful opportunity when people are willing to share some of those deep stories. And I think the more we can give people permission and the more freedom to share some of those deep, painful stories, the more we cannot let men or boys have to carry it by themselves. And so it's part of my journey. And I've also learned that these conversations, as I get to a place of continually growing on myself, is that they help me. That they help me as much as maybe they help the people who listen. That they recognize, that I recognize I'm not alone. And that even I make a mask and the person there makes a mask and we show it and they're like words that are exactly the same. We're like, whoa, how did that happen? Well, who knows? But it's really beautiful in that way. So that's the work that I'm learning from the podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, I really enjoyed the episode with Chip Conley, another person I had seen at Wisdom 2.0. The universe didn't bring him and I together yet, one of these days. But it was just really cool because I know he does a lot of this type of work with the Modern Elder Academy and helping people think about, like, what am I here to do? What is next for me? I've done XYZ for so long. What's next? And it was interesting to hear both sides of his mask and to hear you doing it along with him. And it was just really cool. And I'm going to be on your podcast at some point.
That's
right. If I ever write up my bio and send it to Vanessa. So I'm going to do it. That's another one of those things. That's that fear, right? It's like, who am I? What do I say in this bio? So I've like half filled out your form twice. And then I get to the bio and I'm like, ah.
Well, how about this? I'll tell you right now, you don't have to fill out the bio. How about that? How about that? Yeah, just write one sentence. Just write one sentence. No pressure.
Get it on the calendar.
Get it on the calendar. Let's do it.
I like it. Yeah, that's funny. I really have filled it out half twice and just like ran away.
Oh, man.
And it's just describing myself. Like,
from now on, I'm going to put in parentheses, just one sentence. Don't worry. Whatever, yeah. If you got one sentence, yeah, that's what we'll do.
I'm probably not the only one that is holding back because of that.
I can imagine. I can imagine that to be the case. So glad you named it. So now I'm like, oh, maybe that is. I think about that too. I'm like, oh, wait. Yeah. So thank you. You actually gave me a tip that may be holding people back and I didn't know it. Yeah. So
sure. Yeah. No, it's, I like the process. You're collecting everything you need up front. I still haven't scheduled. So maybe it's holding people back, you know?
True statement. Yeah, true statement.
It's interesting.
Yeah, we interviewed a man, Justin Baldoni, who's a Hollywood actor. And he was like, you gave me homework? I can't believe you gave me homework. And I'm like, Oh, you're right. It could seem like that. Like, I'm not trying to, I was thinking that it's making it easier, but actually it feels to a person, everyone's busy. So it's like, oh, I need to, okay, we're going to scale back some pieces so we don't make it feel like, because the goal is not to make people feel pressurized. The goal is to hopefully lighten the load. But when you said that right there, you gave me a good tip, and I'm going to tell the team when I meet with them.
The second question is, what piece of advice would you give to someone early on their path to financial independence?
Okay. Well, I can give lots of advices. One piece of advice is, if you're going to change your career that takes you from abundance and just fat paycheck to like, I'm going to give back to the planet, which doesn't always pay financially. Like, I would just say, sit down with a financial advisor, sit down with a coach, sit down with a friend, and just make a plan. I think anyone who's asked me recently about leaving their career to become an educator, I always say, do you have a number in mind of how much you need to have stored up? I didn't have a number. Literally, it was not planned. It was not planned. So I did not well plan. So I know the feeling of like getting into the teaching job and realizing, okay, I'm back in grad school. I just didn't strategize well. So I would say, and I don't know financial freedom yet. I think definitely in a better place than the way I grew up, the struggle that we had growing up. So I feel thankful. I feel thankful that I don't have to miss any meals. I think that those kind of things weren't really fun growing up. But I would say it's one thing to have lots of money and not a lot of joy. So I think you have to put a price on your joy. And I think that when I was in engineering, to make that move, I was clear that I was going in a way, and maybe I was thinking I was going to eventually come back to engineering one day. And then after I got this teaching out of my system, and that's 17, 18 years ago. So I think that I would just say, I invite people to really, if you're going to make a career move, to check out the numbers and make sure, not the numbers, whether you should do it, just what do you need to do to strategize the, because when you make the move, it could be a shock to your system. It was a shock to my system. It was a shock to my system, my apartment, my car insurance. It was a shock to my weekend plans. It was a
everything
lot of
was shocked.
Everything was shocked. It was in between flying Emirates and flying Spirit. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a difference. There's a big difference.
Oh, yeah, that's a difference.
There's a big difference. But I would just say, just strategize well and think about, you know, okay, what do I need to do? Do I need to make a 5-month plan or 6-month plan so I can at least store up some? It's like storing up your nest so that when you make that move, it makes it a little easier to land. And that's the best way I can describe it. Yeah.
Yeah. I resonate a lot with that. And that's really how I think about my pursuit of financial independence, right? Like, it's not like I want to retire and do nothing. I want to move towards more meaningful and impactful and purposeful work, like the work that you're doing, or entrepreneurship related stuff. But I want to do it where I don't have to worry about putting food on the table, about supporting my family. So I'm trying to think about that. But then on the other side, something we talked about earlier, you just jumped in. You had a sign and you followed the sign and you jumped in. And maybe you could have done some more planning than we talked about, is what is enough? How do you figure out if you're planning and building your nest, your nest egg that's going to support you to go do this work? When's the nest enough? And when can you make that jump? And I think everyone's got to ask that question and keep asking that question. And I know for sure I'm in that spot.
Yeah. I think it's so beautiful even to be in a place where people are willing to have the conversations. Because I imagine if somebody had talked to me before, like, I don't think that even up until I was making the decision that I knew I was going to be making the decision. So it wasn't like, for some of the decisions we make, they're going to need to be fast and abrupt and quick, because otherwise we'll overthink them and then we'll never make a move, like we talked about also. So I think, like, looking and saying, when somebody is already in the place of moving to a new strategy, I think that I want to be doing something different. It's like, okay, look, what's the timeline looking like for you? I think it's just like having somebody who can ask you some good questions and helpful questions. Not like, why would you do that? That's not the kind of questions you need somebody to ask. It's more of like, okay, so this is the plan. What do you envision it looking like? When is a timeline? What do you envision needing to have already stored up? I'm going back to grad school. Do I need to pay for grad school? Do I need to save up for that? Or am I going to have financial aid? I think just having somebody help think through. And now that I've experienced it, when people come to me and think about those moves, I ask just those questions I wish somebody had asked me. So I think it's just really just learning as we learn. I don't think sometimes I could have known it while it was happening, but I only knew it in hindsight.
Of course. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Having some trusted friends that aren't going to just poo your plans.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
Say, what are you doing? Like, that's a friend you call for something else.
Right. That's right.
You know?
Exactly right. Exactly.
All right. Question number three is, what piece of advice would you give to someone getting started with meditation and or mindfulness?
Yeah. Thank you. So that breath I took right there is how I operate on a regular basis. Is my practice is like a living practice for me. I've done lots of different training classes, and the invitation has been to sit in the morning for maybe half an hour every morning and try that. My sleeping schedule is a little too erratic for that. I've tried to do it at night before I go to bed, and my sleeping schedule is a little too chaotic for that. And I've always been beating myself up because I made some commitments that I would do it, and then I didn't do it. And then you get the email from the workshop, and they're like, hey, are you doing your practice? And you're like, no, I'm not doing it. And I've learned that instead of me trying to do something that is harder for me at the moment, and not that I'm not willing to do hard, how can I do something that fits a little bit better in the way I operate? And sometimes I just stop in the middle. I'm in my office. I just stop and I'm just like, take like five breaths. Sometimes I just like right there, I take one breath. I was like, let me think about this. Sometimes I just use a mindful moment throughout the day. So I'm constantly taking breaths. I'm constantly, I know it's very different than studies have shown a regular practice can do, but I do what's really working for me and how I just stay grounded. When something happens that gets, it's frustrating me, that's getting me activated, and I just take a moment. I'll stop, you know? I don't do it while I'm driving, but I do it when I have a moment to catch my breath. And so my practice is, and so anyone who's starting a practice, find a practice that works for you and build up. I've had practices where I was sitting for 30 minutes a day, and then I just, those don't work currently in my present day. Could I make it happen? Yes, I could make it happen. But I think I've just found that my daily regular practice is constantly staying really mindful and content. And when I can sit, I sit. Like when I can say, you know what, I'm going to take this next 10, 20 minutes and just, so I think that's my work. And I think that I invite people to not overwhelm themselves with trying to follow a practice that then is just going to fall off and sit in the notebook, but that is a living practice through them. So yeah, that's how I operate. And that's how I support the young people I work with. Some of my young men are not going to sit for 20 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day. People have even practices that are even smaller, but I've learned that if I can like incorporate it in my daily, incorporate it when I'm brushing my teeth, if I can incorporate it when I'm getting ready to eat, if I can incorporate it into like just ways of being, then it's part of my life as opposed to like separate from my life starts after I finish that thing. So that's the best way I can answer it.
Oh, that's great advice. You know, that's really great advice because there's formal practice, which is the sitting, and then there's the informal practice, which is the in the moment mindfulness. And both are incredibly important. And you know, if you're not able to connect with the present moment when you need it, then it doesn't matter if you meditate for 3 hours a day. If you don't have it when you need it, then you really don't have much. So I think that's really powerful and is something that hasn't been shared too much here. Happy to have that perspective. And so the final question, Ashanti, is how can people connect with you online, learn more about the work that you're doing with the Ever Forward Club, and show support by either having you come to do workshops at their companies or schools, or to donate to support the work that you do with young people?
Yeah, we invite people to go to our website at everforwardclub.org, everforwardclub.org. You can follow us on social media, all channels at everforwardclub. And if you want to bring us into your schools, please, there's a form to fill out on our website that just says about workshops. You can always email us at everforwardclub@gmail.com. But those are the ways that we invite people to connect, see what we're doing, check out what we've been up to in the world. And if you don't have the resources or your community doesn't have the support, there's ways and tools that you can use on your own. You can get the game, begin to play the game with your students or your community. You can make a mask. You can go online at 100kmasks.com and make a mask anonymously. We'd love you to be a part of this movement. We have a goal of collecting 1 million masks from around the world. So if nothing else, if you tell one person to go and make a mask, you help us get closer to that 1 million. And then when we reach that goal and we start celebrate, you'll be like, I was a part of that movement. And I really hope that you'll be able to say that. So thank you so much for offering. Appreciate you, brother.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ashanti. Thank you for the work that you're doing and your friendship and for joining me today on the show. And I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too, man. Thank you so much. Bye, everybody.
All right. Thanks for joining me on today's episode of the Mindful Fire Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, I invite you to hit subscribe wherever you're listening to this. This just lets the platforms know you're getting value from the episodes and you want to be here when I release additional content. If you're ready to start your Mindful Fire journey, go to mindfulfire.org/start and download my free envisioning guide. In just 10 minutes, this guide will help you craft a clear and inspiring vision for your life. Again, you can download it for free at mindfulfire.org/start. Thanks again, and I'll catch you next time on the Mindful Fire Podcast.